Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, it's another pod this week, another special pod, which we could have convened simply to mention the fact that we've just had our 7 millionth download, which is amazing, but we're actually here for a purpose, Kieran. But let me just get you to bask for a moment in that figure of 7 million, Kieran, because even for an accountant, that's a big number, isn't it?
There's lots of zeros there. Yes. Thank you to people for listening. We're still slightly bewildered, but we appreciate the feedback and the commitment from so many of you.
Yeah, so we have a special interview for you, the second one this week. But this one is more special, I think. No disrespect to our lovely lawyer, Tom, that we spoke to, but we've been talking about the idea of an independent regulator in football, Kieran, almost from the very first pod. And we've already spoken to the person who led the fan-led review into that very thing. And today, this is Thursday, you'll be listening on Friday, but today the white paper was introduced that followed the fan-led review, which you took part in, conducted by Tracy Crouch, CBE, MP for Chatham and Aylesford, and the chair, as we say, of that fan-led review into football governance. It was time restricted because, as you can imagine, she's got an awful lot of people to speak to today, but we were lucky enough to be on that list. As you know, everybody, I'm not Jeremy Paxman, but it's quite difficult, I found, to conduct an interview with somebody about whom you agree on just about everything in football. But this is what Tracy had to say, and very interesting it was too. Tracy Crouch, thank you so much for joining us. And first of all, congratulations on your recent wedding and your even more recent CBE. Who did you receive your CBE from? Which member of the royal family?
Rather wonderfully, I received it from Princess Royal, who I've met on numerous occasions through various sporting events. And so it felt quite weird being formal with her, because I normally meet her in a lot more sort of informal circumstances. And unsurprisingly, we talked about sport.
Of course, yeah. And apparently she's very funny as well, I hear.
She is very funny, yes. Yeah. And she's lovely. And she's a genuine person. She's genuinely very enthusiastic about sport, particularly Olympic sport. But she gets it. She watches and reads about developments in all sorts of different sports.
Yeah, Kieran and I often speculate who's going to hand us our medal, but it might be some time before that happens, Tracy. In the meantime, to business, congratulations as well, I suppose, because the white paper is here. Your fan-led review was completed in November 2021. It was endorsed by the government in April 2022. Are you frustrated by the delay, or is that the normal sort of time span for this sort of thing?
No, I don't think it's the normal sort of time span. I remember when I responded to the minister's statement back in early 2022 and encouraged him to get on with it because of events, I felt like I was speaking as a wise old hand who'd been in Parliament since 2010 and seen things happen in pretty crazy times. Of course, none of us perhaps would have predicted what the next 6 months were then going to do. And you know, those events have really just scuppered the timetable. I think that Stuart Andrew, who was appointed sports minister under Liz Truss and then retained the position under Rishi Sunak, has shown great patience and perseverance in order to get this out.
Now the white paper is here, Tracy, is there a sense of pride, of relief, or is it all in a day's work?
No, there is a great deal of pride and relief in this. I mean, I think not just for me, but also for the panel, for the tens of thousands of fans who participated in the fan-led review, but also I think for the future of football. I think that something quite historic has happened. And I think that the vulnerabilities that we've seen in football in the past, you know, will hopefully remain in the past as this becomes law and that we can set up an independent regulator that has that oversight of everyday spending in football clubs.
And are you satisfied that all the key findings of your fan-led review have been fully realised in the white paper?
Yeah, I mean, there is a difference between all of the recommendations and the key recommendations. And the key recommendations were the introduction of the independent regulator, better corporate governance, oversight, potential oversight of financial redistribution, which I'm sure we'll come on to, giving fans a say. There are, of course, things that are different to what it is that I recommended. But in a way, I don't mind that. It does show that government has really seriously looked and reviewed at the recommendations in the fan-led review. You'll recall that there were concerns that the review wasn't independent. And I think actually the fact that they have reviewed and tweaked and amended and revised and in some cases dropped recommendations, I think it shows that they have really considered this in great detail.
Before we discuss some of those key issues, Tracy, can you give us an idea what the legislative process is now and how long that will actually take?
Yeah, so the government has to go through a consultation process with a white paper. It is doing what is called a targeted consultation process, which means that it is targeted at the key stakeholders. Therefore, it can be significantly shorter in a time period than if it wasn't a targeted one. So it'll be a four week targeted consultation. The government then has to review those responses, and then it will be drawing up the actual legislation, which will then be introduced at the appropriate time in Parliament. Now that is sort of, you know, coded parliamentary speak for the fact that actually the monarch has to introduce legislation in a session. So that you would expect when we next have the King's speech, as it will be now, that there will be a nod to legislation in what is called that parliamentary session.
I mean, forgive my lack of knowledge on this, Tracy, but it's been a long time since I did British Constitution at school. Do all white papers get equal weight? Are they all considered of the same importance?
In what sense? You mean as in sort of from departments?
In terms of priority, in terms of, you know, will they all be in the King's speech at the same time, or will some be given more priority than others?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think the fact is that that this legislation will be quite narrowly drawn legislation, i.e. it will be legislation that is designed to set up a regulator and give it its powers. It is a bill that will have cross-party consensus, so shouldn't really face significant stumbling blocks in Parliament, and it should pass reasonably swiftly without, you know, much change or challenge to it. That's not the case for all pieces of legislation, so I would anticipate that this is something that could come forward quite early and be settled in time for it to be all up and running in place by the 2024 season.
Oh, that's good. That's very – that's great, in fact. I'm talking of the independent regulator, Tracy, I'm going to ask you two questions now, and I'm aware that the second one will make me sound like a hypocrite. Firstly, what do you say to those who claim that the Premier League charges against Manchester City were timed to coincide with the original release of the white paper to show that football can regulate itself? Thank you very much. And secondly, are you a bit annoyed that there's been so much focus from people like me on the independent regulator compared to all the other brilliant stuff that was in the review?
Well, taking that last question first, no, not at all. I think that the independent regulator is something that has been called for a long time. My colleague in Parliament, Damian Collins, made reference to the fact that the first review into governance in football happened in 2011. Myself and other sports ministers have for decades now been talking about how football needs to resolve, you know, some of the issues, some of the vulnerabilities that cause crisis in football. If not, you know, government will do something to do it, you know, to sort it for them. So I think the focus on the independent regulator is an entirely natural thing for anybody who is interested in football to do. So I think that there is a welcome focus on the need for an independent regulator. And I keep on saying to people who ask about this, and you know, I've been doing a lot of media today about the Premier League's concerns around an independent regulator, let's just reflect on a second why we are here. You know, we are here because the existing regulatory structures have failed in a variety of different ways over the course of the last few years and you know, decades, actually. And we are here today because there was an attempt to break away by six clubs to break away from the Premier League, and at which point the Premier League asked government to intervene to support it. So all these things have accumulated over time that have led to any reasonable person with any smidgen of knowledge of football or regulation coming to the conclusion that an independent regulator was needed.
And what about the answer to the timing of the Man City charges?
Well, it's not for me to comment on things like that, but you know, I allow the more cynical and sceptical commentators in the world of football to make such comparisons or commentary on the matter. But in a way, you know, when you look at the charges, they were going back, what, to 2009, 2010, 2011. You know, you'd sit there and think, why weren't they dealt with over that period of time? And by the way, those sorts of issues, those are breaches of rules that would still remain within the remit of the Premier League. That's not something for the independent regulator anyway.
Oh, that's interesting. Also, reading the press release yesterday, this is the independent regulator for the men's elite game will be established in law. Does that mean that any decisions by the regulator wouldn't be able to be challenged?
Oh, you can challenge the law.
Right, okay. I'm just wondering about how the process will work. And I mean, not having had time to scan the white paper properly. So it's any decision that the regulator's made, there will be a process.
There's always an appeal process within the kind of decisions that are made. So, I mean, I think it's really important to stop thinking that this is some sort of kind of new, crazy, far out, wild initiative. You know, most of our businesses, our sectors are regulated in one way or another, and there are well-tested processes in place for, you know, when people seek clarification or anything like that. The regulator is not there to make, you know, life exceptionally difficult for football clubs. It's there to provide security and a safety net for football clubs.
Nevertheless, are you expecting resistance to the white paper and the idea of a regulator from within the game? One lawyer we spoke to said we could be about to see a sort of legal guerrilla war going on in the next couple of months.
No, because actually the only thing that can happen now is a challenge to the process. So they can't challenge, no one can challenge a policy outcome. They can only challenge the way that that policy outcome was reached, i.e. via means of judicial review. But the process is and continues to be followed. And I'm not sure that it would do the Premier League much good in terms of its reputation if it were to challenge the outcome of something that arguably they asked for when they asked government to intervene to support them from sick clubs breaking away.
I'll come on to the potential Super League in a moment. But for me, Tracy, what we've seen happen with the charges against Birmingham this week, what we could see happen to Southend next week, indicated that the white paper's planned changes to the owners and directors test are an urgent priority. Tell me a little bit more about what those changes are, and particularly about the notion of integrity tests and real-time financial checks.
Yeah, so I think, again, we're not reinventing any wheels here. We're just applying how it happens in other businesses to football. And the white paper does go into more detail about those kind of tests. But it is something that enables for real-time financial monitoring. It will enable to ensure that owners, you know, have good business plans, that they have the means to invest in their clubs, and so on. And it's all going to be part of the license conditions for football clubs to be able to operate. So I think that, you know, it really stresses and stretches the owner's test, but it also will have a review aspect to it. So at the moment, under the current rules, you know, if somebody commits some sort of criminal activity, then they can still continue to be an owner of a football club. This won't be the case going forward. And I think, you know, we've seen examples of that over the years where an owner has done something criminal and nothing has changed. And remember, the only way that Abramovich was forced out of Chelsea was the fact that we sanctioned a regime. So, you know, I think that it's going to be really interesting in how it evolves. But again, I don't think it's going to be something that puts off good investors in football clubs in the English pyramid.
I'd like to bring Kieran in here, if I may, Tracy. Kieran, I would be interested to hear what you think about the new owners and directors rules, but also what you think of what seems to me as a layman, I wouldn't say radical, but a fairly decent financial redistribution suggestions, the sort of thing that we've been asking for since the very start of the pod.
I think it's addressing what we've said on many occasions, that the identification and the acknowledgement that there are cliff edges, not only between the Premier League and the Championship, but also between the Championship and League One, and also between League Two and the National League, and anything which addresses this on a holistic basis is to be encouraged. So yeah, I'm absolutely chuffed a bit with what I'm reading. I've got the white paper here in front of me, and I'm getting out my highlighter and go, oh, that's good. Yeah, it's progressive. It's not going to be a burden in terms of compliance, in terms of the efforts that individual clubs will have to undertake. And it will encourage people to act in a more sensible manner. You should be having business plans at this level of business. So it's simply effectively codifying what is good business practice, which surely has got to be encouraged.
And also, Tracy, what I like about it, love about it really, as a long-time football fan, is it kind of recognises in law that most football fans are sensible people who should be allowed to have a say in matters off the field at the club that they've supported for years. Things like, you know, name changes, badge changes, kit changes, stadium changes. It's quite a big thing to admit that. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, I think it's an acknowledgement that actually fans are an integral part to the success of the football club. And, you know, remember seeing all those posters that were held up by fans during the ESL of, you know, football is nothing without fans. And that's absolutely true. But then football communities are nothing without fans and football clubs. And, you know, we saw the outcome of the devastating impact that Bury Football Club going had on its local community. And I think that's when people started to understand why football was important. You know, there was a real shift, I think, in Parliament around politicians talking about football. I mean, you've had people like me and others who are football fans who somehow managed to weave their love of the sport and their club into almost everything that they do. But others would just sort of kind of raise an eyebrow, not really understand why it was important. And then Bury happened and people were like, oh, we get it now. We understand it's not just about, you know, 90 minutes on the pitch with players rolling around pretending they've just been shot by a sniper. You know, it's actually a much, much greater thing than that. And I think that once, sadly, you know, it was a tragedy for all involved in Bury, but it really changed people's minds here in Parliament about why something had to be done.
Well, that is really interesting as well to see in that official government press release that both Bury and Macclesfield were cited as examples of exactly why something needed to be done. So, which is small consolation for those clubs. But also the press release talked about, I think, 66 clubs that have been into administration since the first review. I mean, it's an acknowledgement that something has been badly wrong for quite a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, my worry is that, you know, you guys have built a really successful podcast on the back of financial failures and vulnerabilities in football. And, you know, the white paper and its implementation could mean the end of this podcast.
Oh, my Lord. You know what? We haven't thought that through, Tracy. I think we should stop this interview right now. You're damaging.
Start a counter campaign.
You're a dangerous radical seditionary. This is not good enough.
I'm a Maoist.
Yeah, who was it who called you a Maoist?
Angus Kinnear.
Angus Kinnear.
I'd quite like a badge.
That must have been a proud moment for you to be called a Maoist. And this, when you talk about the Super League, this could spell the end, couldn't it, for any potential English club involvement in a European Super League?
It's not could, it would.
Good.
You know, and I think that's, you know, that one's one of the key asks for the Premier League when they face the threat of the breakaway of government, and this certainly delivers on that.
Will there eventually be an independent regulator for the Women's Elite game as well?
That I don't know. There's a women's review going on at the moment, rightly so. We've seen a phenomenal growth in women's football, professional women's football. And much of that is tied into the men's elite game as well. So there is concerns which were raised by fans during the consultation process about will the women's game make the same mistakes that the men's game has made? Is there a way of enhancing and growing the women's game in a different way? You know, do the structures need to be put in place? And that's something that Karen Carney is looking at, following on from the recommendation that I put in the review to have a separate review into women's game. And I believe that will report at some point during 2023. It is an important question to ask, and there's lots of different ways of you know, looking at the future of women's football. So I think, you know, Karen's doing a great job looking at these issues, and it'll be interesting to see what she comes up with.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Unfortunately, Tracy, we've been speaking to a lot of women in football, both players, coaches and broadcasters recently, and there are quite a few of them who worry that the same mistakes have already been made, that you already have four elite clubs that are kind of dominating the game, winning everything, the money, the sponsorship is heading towards them already, and that the distribution model in women's football isn't as good as it should be, considering it's almost coming from a standing start.
Yeah, and I get those concerns, and those were concerns that were raised as well. But in a way, you know, as somebody who was banned from playing football when they were little, I also welcome the fact that we're having these discussions now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, wasn't it amazing that during the January transfer window, Alicia Russo's potential transfer to Arsenal was leading, you know, some of the running commentary. And I just think, wow, you know, that's never happened before. And so it's important that we remember that there is a growth happening. Let's embrace that growth. Let's make sure we have the right structures in place so that, you know, there isn't necessarily the same mistakes going forward.
Yeah, and yet at the same time, there are still schools that won't let girls play football. It's outrageous.
It's pretty extraordinary. But there's a whole different podcast on what we need to do in terms of kids and PE and girls and football.
Finally, Tracy, because we're aware that there are time limitations, you've had fulsome praise from the Prime Minister, the Culture Secretary, and the Sports Minister, which you would probably expect, but you've also had an absolutely wholehearted endorsement from the Football Supporters Association. And that bit must make you very happy, because essentially it's a Football Supporters Association and people like us that this legislation is for, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Football supporters throughout the pyramid, into non-league, into grassroots, they've been fundamental to the development of these proposals. I think the good thing is that, you know, quite often people view Parliament as this, you know, political kind of non-stop argument on things. And there's absolutely sort of kind of universal consensus on making changes, bringing in reform into football. So in a way, it's nice that we're in a happy place when quite often there's just complete, you know, arguments about everything. So I do genuinely hope that that will enable a really swift consultation and introduction. And one of the good things about the white paper is that it does reference bringing in a shadow regulator, so that actually the structures can be set up and tested in time for the actual implementation and enactment of the regulator once the legislation passes.
Is there a worry? I meant to ask you this earlier, talking about the independent regulator. Is there a worry from those people who are so resistant to the idea that the very notion of whoever's appointed, that their independence is called into doubt? I mean, we've already seen that with the person who may be leading the Man City inquiry. People say, well, he's an Arsenal fan, so he can't possibly be independent. Does that mean you have to look for somebody from outside the game, do you think?
That will be a matter for later on, I think, in the process. But in my mind, the independent regulator was somebody that is independent of the game. You need somebody who has an understanding and a knowledge of football. But this is about financial regulation. You actually want somebody who is really sort of kind of nerdy about capital and liquidity and, you know, accounting procedures and things like that. It doesn't really matter who they support, if they support anybody at all. You know, that's not necessarily of interest. But it is, you know, you do have to have a step removed, I think, in terms of government. You don't necessarily want it to be a political appointment. That would be my view. There are regulators out there that are appointed by a panel, not the Prime Minister. I think that might be helpful. But that's something that the government will look at in more detail.
Tracy, it shouldn't be of interest what football club they support, but you know what football fans are like. If a Brighton fan got the job, I'd be absolutely furious. But speaking of which, I mean, we all know the ideal candidate for the job, Tracy, but unfortunately, Kieran's too busy with his media career. So otherwise,
yeah, with this podcast that's now going to fold because of my white paper.
Hang on a second, it's all falling into place. You fold the podcast, Kieran gets a job as independent regulator. Finally, Tracy, we know there are people in the game that are wary, to say the least, or fiercely resistant to the idea of an independent regulator and possibly to some of the changes that you'll be suggesting about the redistribution of finances. What do you say in a few short words to those people who are so against this idea of independence and fairness in the game?
Well, what's really interesting is that a lot of people are not as hostile to the idea as that is perhaps being made out. There are some very vocal commentators on it, for sure. But the Premier League itself has been quite muted. It's certainly publicly muted on today's announcement. Many of the individual clubs within the Premier League have engaged privately with civil service, with myself, and indicated a support for a regulator. And so you do sort of kind of often wonder why. What is behind people's hostility to the regulator? Is it because they might uncover things themselves? You know, I just don't know who these exceptionally hostile people are and why they are so hostile. But, you know, that's for them to worry about. The fact is that other football authorities, the FA, the EFL, engaged very positively and proactively in the process of both the fan-led review and then subsequent discussions with government on it. That hasn't necessarily been the case with the Premier League. And we are where we are because of failings in some of the authorities, both Premier League, EFL and FA. So I just sit there and think, you need to reflect, pause and reflect as to why we got to this position in the first place.
It's really interesting to hear you say that, Tracy, that there has been engagement and approach from Premier League clubs and the EFL, because the perception certainly is that there is a large degree of unified opposition to this. So maybe it's just that the one or two people who are against it have better contacts in the media than the people that are generally supportive.
I think that's probably a fair comment. You know, quite often when you do hear somebody go into the studios, you know, my phone buzzes, and I'm sure other people's phones buzz to say, I just want you to know that is not our view, or that is not the view of the collective XYZ, you know. So, but it is very difficult, I think, to have a collective view on some of these issues. But I just don't, there are some people that are very keen to have their voices heard. But I stand by the point that I don't think that they always represent the entire, in many circumstances, the entire Premier League.
Tracy, thank you very much for talking to us. Hopefully when the legislation is enacted, we can talk again and share a glass of virtual champagne over the airwaves as we celebrate what I think is a remarkable piece of potential legislation. You must, as we say, be very satisfied. It's been a long, long process involving a lot of people, but congratulations on getting it to this stage.
Well, thank you. As I say, I'm just pleased for the fans that, you know, hopefully this will protect the future of their football clubs.
Yeah, and now we'll sit back and wait for all those tweets saying, well, you're just on her side, aren't you? To which I'll respond, yes. The Price of Football podcast has been on your side right from the very start, just as we're on the side of the Football Supporters Association and all those fans who worry on a daily basis about the future of their club, as Southend fans are doing as we speak. So anything you do to change that situation is welcomed by every genuine football fan, Tracy. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Kieran, there's a couple of things. I mean, she was fantastic, Chase. I mean, she must be exhausted. But it strikes me as a couple of things. There is resistance, Kieran, no matter what Tracy thinks. I mean, very public resistance from people in football. David Sullivan, for example, just this week has been very vocal in his opposition to the white paper, has he not?
Yeah, and I found that quite strange because David Sullivan's been involved in two football clubs, the first of which was Birmingham City. He sold Birmingham City to someone where we didn't have a particularly robust regime of scrutiny. And the person he sold the club to ended up doing time for money laundering. And you go, well, if David's saying that all is well with the way that football runs itself and does that, that seems very odd. And then you've got to look at the second club he's involved with, which is West Ham United. Well, when he bought West Ham United, it was because the previous owners had been in deep trouble. Remember, they were owned by an Icelandic bank and they were in genuine danger of going out of business themselves. So I can't understand why anybody that's been involved in two football clubs whose existence at times, and let's face it, there are outstanding issues with Birmingham City at present, has been called into question. And yeah, we're talking about two massive clubs as well. Yeah, and the impact that it would have on those people, why he wouldn't want a system which is there as a safety net. You know, the purpose of the regulator is not there to tell clubs how to run themselves. It's there that if things start to go a bit wobbly, then it's there to as a protection. It's a bit like having an airbag in a car. You know, most of the time, you won't know it's there and you won't need to use it. But at times, it can be an absolute lifesaver.
Interesting as well, Kieran, that when I said this could spell the end for any potential English club involvement in the European Super League, Tracy was unequivocal, saying it will spell the end for any potential English club involvement.
Yes, and I agree with her absolutely theoretically, I mean, it could come to pass that Manchester United fans want to join the European Super League. And if that is the case, well, we'll let them go. But certainly from you know, I, as you know, I played for Trafford Cricket Club. I work in Liverpool. There is absolutely zero indication from the fans of these clubs. And yeah, I don't want to go into I'm a better fan than you mentality. But you know, the lads I speak to are from Urmston and Gorton and Highton and Liverpool City Centre. Yeah, and they are the local fans. I appreciate that some of the international fans might be more relaxed about Super League, but there's certainly no evidence of any desire to want to get away. And yeah, even when I talk to Liverpool fans, they say to me, "Well, if we don't get into the top four of the Premier League this season, it's because we weren't good enough. And therefore, we shouldn't be in the Champions League next season. And we just fight and we move on and we try to improve next season." And, you know, they say it will make, you know, part of the love of football is that it is competitive to an extent. You know, we know that there are huge gaps in terms of revenues between the big six and the other clubs. But there is still an element of hope. And there is still this broad sense of a meritocracy, which I think is something which should be cherished and preserved.
I don't know where you get the time, Kieran. Well, I do know where you get the time because you get up at 5 o'clock in the morning for some bizarre reason. But you've had more chance to look at some of the key issues in the white paper. I doubt if even you have managed to peruse the whole lot or found any small print yet. But what's immediately struck you, right, and in particular, Kieran, as I hinted on the pod, I'd be very interested to hear what you make of the, I think, seemingly quite radical plans for financial redistribution in the game?
Yes, I think first of all, there's an acknowledgement that the Premier League has been very successful, and that is there to be applauded. And the Premier League clubs should be the major beneficiaries of that achievement. But there's no reason why, provided the money is not wasted, and that has been an issue historically at the lower levels of football. If it goes, if extra money is given to clubs in the EFL and that goes straight through into increased employment costs, increased spend on transfers, then I think that's not the right way to go ahead. But reading sort of between the lines, I can sort of sense a three-tier approach to distribution. First of all, the government and the regulator it appoints doesn't particularly want to get involved in the individual bun fight between the Premier League and the EFL, because otherwise, it under the rules of blame game, it will always be targeted by both the Premier League and the EFL, because everybody, you know, if you're not satisfied with the whole deal, then you're looking for a scapegoat, and that would become the regulator. And that wouldn't be good in terms of relationships. So I think the first thing that the regulators is likely to say is, right, we're going to let you two try to sort it out, and this is what happens if you don't. First of all, we will go to arbitration. Yeah, we will try, you know, like all good disputes. And remember, Nick DeMarco always said this to us, arbitration is better than litigation. So we'll try to go arbitration. And if they can't sort themselves out through arbitration, this is what I anticipate. And this is something that we teach students. It's something called game theory. We will say to both parties, both the Premier League and the EFL, right, we've tried to knock your heads together. You've refused. What we want is two sealed bids in terms of what you think the distribution mechanism should be. And then the regulator is going to look at those two bids, and whichever one the regulator thinks is the most sensible will be the one that's applied. So this is actually going to, in theory, it's going to force both of those bodies, if it comes to this far, to actually say, well, you know, am I pushing for too much? Am I not prepared to give away enough? And looking at the potential losses, if that perhaps they don't reach an element of goodwill, And you know, the EFL has said it wants 25%. It's not being prepared to budge. And part of the reason why it's not being prepared to budge is that the Premier League has never actually formally put anything on the table. There have been talks about, presently the Premier League gives around about 16% from the whispers that I get. I think it's willing to go up to 19. The EFL wants parachute payments scrapped. I think the Premier League, and again, I'm a little bit more sympathetic here, is saying, well, we're willing to compromise on parachute payments. You know, my personal view, for example, is that they are too high and they're too long. You shouldn't need them for more than 2 years. And remember, we still have parachute payments in the EFL itself. So it would seem inconsistent to have them in the EFL and not the Premier League when the EFL are the ones who are so opposed to it. So you have both parties, they put together an offer, and it's going to be one or the other. And what you find in any form of sort of you know, business modelling is that you get two scenarios which probably either aren't too far apart from each other, or one of them is such a load of old cobblers that it gets completely rejected and the other party wins. So to me, the people that have been behind this report, and you know, the critics will say, well, it's the government. Well, the government's actually employed professionals to do this. It's employed civil servants. Yep. Those civil servants have had conversations with a vast variety of stakeholders. They've listened to the Premier League. They've listened to the EFL. They've listened to people with a background in finance who like football and a background in sort of you know, standard legal positions and so on. And they put together, from what I'm seeing here, is a comprehensive, measured and proportionate proposal. It's cross party. You know, this is not a Tory party a white paper or a Labour white paper. It is one which has been led, in my view, by common sense. And I don't think individual political parties can start to pick holes in it. And there's no evidence that they would do anyway.
I don't think there's any political mileage in doing so either. Do you? Really?
No, absolutely not.
Apart from getting David Sullivan's vote at the next election, obviously.
Yes.
I am starting to get slightly paranoid, Kieran, though, that all along you and Tracy Crouch have been involving me in your cunning web of deceit. That right from the very first pod, your plan has been that Tracy will introduce a white paper that makes this podcast redundant, and then you will get the job as independent regulator. And I'll be outside the House of Commons watching you go in with a little bowl saying, "We'll tell jokes for money."
Brilliant.
Would you take the job? I mean, you're not going to get offered the job, Kieran. So I don't know.
No,
why
I'm
offered
the job. So
but,
it is.
But would you? Can you imagine the Baroness? How happy would the Baroness be if you were the independent regulator of football, Kieran?
I think I'm the last person to be offered the job, and also it's far better for me to be outside the tent throwing grenades than inside.
That's true. And so well done for using that analogy rather than the more common one. I'll tell you who the last person to be offered the job is, Kieran, the Prowler. You're the second last person to be offered the job. I think the Prowler, yes. If the Prowler gets the job, we all know there's been a terrible mishap in the recruitment process. Thank you to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And Kieran and I would like to end, and producer Guy would like to join us, by thanking, and I know it's not 7 million people that have downloaded, it's a large amount of people that have downloaded that many times, but thank you to each and every one of you who has listened to our pod, especially those people who listen on a weekly basis. We really do value your company and your feedback. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.